Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 83 of the Alabama Liberal Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about gentrification versus globalism. Are these sort of the same thing? Are they complementary to each other? And why is one of them more negative than the other? We think of one of them as usually generally positive, or liberals do anyway, and the other is very negative, or liberals do, I should say. So why is that if they're somewhat similar in everything? And these are going to be interesting questions that we delve into. Let's take a quick moment that's sort of relevant to last week's episode, or the last episode, where I mentioned something about the sex scandals for Andrew Cuomo. I just like to say, once again, Alabama Liberal was correct. And I don't just mean that Colton Underwood, that bachelor who wouldn't have sex with beautiful women, I don't just mean he was gay, because I called that one from like a mile away. You know, this guy's surrounded by gorgeous women, makes up reasons not to sleep with them, about like Tim Tebow or some, you know, other closet case like that. I was like, yeah, that guy's definitely gay. There's no way he's not. He had Taisha Adams. Now, for those who are even remotely familiar with the Bachelor franchise, she's like the hottest bachelorette they've ever had. She's probably the most physically attractive, I think just attractive period bachelorette they've ever had. She only gets her shot because a white woman quits her season very early on into the season. She quits and is like, oh, I love this one guy, I'm not interested in the others or whatever. Taisha gets the leftovers of a 40-year-old woman's season, the oldest bachelorette they've ever had, finds love immediately, quits. Must not realize that, you know, this is a competition reality show. You have 30 guys to choose from. You can take a minute, you know, you don't got to just, but, oh, this one, he's willing to get married. And of course he wasn't. Taisha gets the leftovers of the guys that she hasn't already eliminated. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, this is so messed up. This shows you the problems in that the hottest bachelorette they've ever had, the most attractive, has to come into a season in the middle of it and pick through the rummagings of some older white woman who just like, these are the guys that she hadn't already thrown away, right? Colton, one of his seasons, Taisha was on there and he was like, oh, I don't want to sleep with you. Basically coming up with all these reasons. And I'm like, yeah, no guy's that religious. We talk about, oh, religion is such a good thing, usually a very negative thing. But no guy is that religious that he's turning down women. In Alabama, personal story, there was a guy that went to high school with me. Beautiful women kind of liked him or whatever, wanted to sleep with him. And he's like, no, I'm saving myself for Jesus. I'm too religious for that. And I was like, you're gay. There's no way. There's no way that that's not true. And he was. And he came out years later. Yeah. So I think generally speaking, you know, I don't think any guy is really that religious. And I think that it's a negative thing for religion to tell people, don't have sex ever. Don't think about that ever. And now we're getting to that stage where sort of like the parties have flopped on some sexual issues and some things like that, which brings me to Andrew Cuomo, which is where forever Democrats were the ones getting in these sex scandals and kind of wasn't a big deal. JFK, FDR, things like that. It was Republicans that were like, oh, we don't put our PP in the wrong place or whatever. And the media was obsessed with that. So, but now it's sort of flip-flopped. Bill Clinton almost gets impeached for a blowjob. I ran through a list of the New York-based politicians. Eric Schneiderman, the attorney general from New York, had to resign over a sex scandal. Anthony Weiner, the notorious congressman, didn't actually have sex with anybody, but had to resign anyway. Elliot Spitzer slept with a prostitute, had to resign for that. So the last governor before David Patterson was the lieutenant governor who was the interim, but the last real governor before Cuomo also had to resign over a sex scandal. And a New York congressman, and the New York attorney general. And so with Cuomo, I'm like, no, you shouldn't resign. You should stay there and let them move on, because 2 weeks from now, there will be another sex scandal. They will move on. Democrats should do what Republicans do and say, we don't care about this. We're not going to lose a good politician over some stupid bullshit like this. And that's what he did. And Alabama Liberal, once again, was proven correct. First, it was that skinny prick from Silicon Valley. I don't even know his name, but Thomas Middlehitch. He got Me Too'd, and they kind of started to move on to that. Then they were getting a little bored with that. But then Matt Gaetz comes out with this spectacular flame out. There's statutory rape. There's charges he went to the Caribbean. He might have been brought up on sex trafficking charges. My favorite part is that he asked Trump for a blank pardon. Wouldn't tell him what it was for, but wanted to be pardoned. I didn't even know you could do that. I didn't know you could be pardoned for crimes you may not have committed yet, or just have a pardon in your back pocket. I mean, like, what is this, the King Times? Is this the 16th century? Oh, I'm the king's advisor. I can rape your village and nothing can happen to me. You know, like, that just sounds so insane to me that that even exists. Didn't know you could be pardoned for crimes that you didn't have to specify or had not even committed yet. I thought that was nuts. Trump, the craziest man in America, said, I can't do that. That's how extreme this idea was, that he didn't want to do it and couldn't do it. But Matt Gaetz, he pushed Andrew Cuomo off the front page of the news. The media moved on, as I knew they would. With the media, the cycle is, they come out and demand that you resign, even if the voters don't give a shit. And there's no empirical evidence that New York voters want him to resign or care. about this at all. And next year, I assume he won't run again because he's already been doing it enough times. He might be term limited out. I don't know if he can run again. But 2022, his time's over anyway. So the natural thing is to stay in office until your term is over. And then that's it. But they're demanding that he step down and all this. And I thought, why? Because what kills me about this, the worst thing about it, is that it let Greg Abbott off the hook completely. The Texas governor, who really should be the one everybody's asking to resign, he's letting people freeze to death in the middle of a blizzard. But then we got to care about where Andrew Cuomo puts his pee-pee, right? We got to care about if he has sex or if he touched a woman or if he, I don't know, hugged one the wrong way or something. I couldn't even follow these allegations. They were so nebulous. I mean, some of these women have a extremely lofty idea of what sexual harassment is, what constitutes sexual. And they're all different. They're different allegations and some are worse than others. But I mean, I really think they had a very lofty idea of what constitutes sexual harassment in a hostile workplace. But with Cuomo, it started out that he got Me Too last year. And then the election happened and there was the insurrection and they kind of moved on from that for a minute. Then it came out, oh, the nursing home deaths, he underreported those. Then it came out again with some more Me Too allegations. Then they started to say stuff like, oh, well, his brother, did he get the vaccination before he could have? Did Chris Cuomo, did he give him preferential treatment? He was a CNN anchor. They were all given preferential treatment. All the fucking celebrities have been given preferential treatment. There are celebrities my age, younger than me, that have gotten the vaccine months ago, okay? They all did this. They all cut to the front of the line. I mean, you think Oprah Winfrey, you think she didn't get the vaccine the first 2 weeks it was out? But because Chris Cuomo is his brother, I feel that there was a very coordinated effort to hurt him in some way. And it was very reminiscent to me of Elliot Spitzer. Allegations were organized by Kenneth Langone, and Roger Stone was in the middle of that. But Roger Stone was in the middle of the Al Franken allegations. So I remember in the last episode, I compared the Al Franken stuff to the Andrew Cuomo stuff, where I'm like, you know, the media wanted Franken to resign immediately. Then when he did, it was like, oh, well, maybe we were rushed to judgment. Maybe we were too hasty, which anybody could have told them at the time that they were being too hasty. And then they come out and do the same thing to Andrew Cuomo as though they've learned nothing. I had to go back and think up the specifics of Spitzer, but once I saw Roger Stone was right in the mix of that, Roger Stone was also in the mix of the Al Franken allegations. I thought, have we checked that bastard's whereabouts for the Cuomo thing? Do we know where he was when all this was happening? Because if you got Roger Stone in the mix of this Cuomo thing, I really think that its history just repeats itself over and over and over. And it really comes down to the fact of, once again, a good politician could have been ruined by Roger Stone. For all we know, he's in the mix of this somehow. But there was a very clear, coordinated campaign and an effort to knock this guy out of power somehow, some way. And it usually comes with the same things in New York. Somebody's a populist leader. Elliot Spitzer wanted to hurt Wall Street. Wall Street didn't like that, obviously. They got rid of Spitzer. Anthony Weiner used to give speeches against Wall Street. They didn't like that. They wanted to get rid of him. Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, he wanted to treat the fossil fuel companies like big tobacco. He wanted to charge them for all the lies and mistruths that they've been spreading for 60 years about climate crisis. Then he's gone. So for all we know, Andrew Cuomo, you know, I know that a lot of people were mad at Gavin Newsom and Cuomo in the business sector because they were losing a lot of money because of the shutdowns. Maybe they thought a different lieutenant governor would be a little more helpful to them in some way or something like that. Who knows? Who can fathom it? We'll find out a year from now what it really was. But I think there was probably almost certainly a business reason for wanting to get him gone so badly, which once again goes back to an Alabama liberal video where I said the Me Too movement was a pawn of big business. Les Moonves, the president of CBS, they wanted him out of the way so they could merge CBS and Paramount together again. Sharon Redstone wanted that badly. He's gone, and they merged it back together. Harvey Weinstein, one of the last semi-independent movie producers and studios out there, they've been wanting him gone forever. He's gone. Not saying that these men are incapable of doing bad stuff or that there has never been a man who's done bad stuff, but Louis C.K., I remember he was really pissing people off because he was releasing these stand-up specials live from his website. He wanted to cut out the middleman. He didn't need the big media companies to start releasing his own content. He filmed a show called Horace and Pete. He released that through his own website and charged money for that. He did shows at the Beacon Theater, released that through his own website. He was finding out that really celebrities with the internet, they can cut out the middleman. They really don't need to be hosted by a big media company anymore if their platform is big enough and if they're famous enough. So naturally, what do? Kill the demand for him. Because one night in a hotel room, he exposed himself to two women that knew what they were there for. So when you begin to look at, is there big business reasons that some people can get Me Too'd and nothing ever happened to them? And then other people like CK and Kevin Spacey, who was one of the first people to sign up with Netflix with House of Cards, Harvey Weinstein, Les Moonves, they can get me to it and then have to disappear to the point where even their spouse with Les Moonves had to resign from some of her jobs that she had. So you can look at this and start to think, is there reasons that different people are being treated differently? And maybe there's a business component to some of this, which I said years ago in a YouTube video that has had like 12 views or something outrageously low like that. And yet it's happening. Como didn't resign, and he shouldn't have, because the media will exhaust themselves. They'll say, you must resign for about 2 weeks. And then if you do resign, then they have something else to cover for about 2 weeks. So then they get two more weeks out of that with covering that. But if you don't, there's nowhere for the story to go eventually. Eventually, they have to kind of give up because there's no popular support for this shit. It's just stuff that the media wants and tries to force down our throats. Because they start with Greg Abbott, who commits a real crime by letting people freeze to death in their Texas homes. Then they get bored with that, and they move on to Ted Cruz, who went to Cancun, Mexico while the blizzards were happening. Then they get bored with that. Then they move on to Andrew Cuomo, and they demand that he resign. Then they get bored with that. Then they move on to Matt Gaetz. He's not going to resign. He'll have to be forced out of office because he's a Republican. They never resign. They have to be forced out. And in 3 weeks, they'll move on to something else. And so it really becomes, do they even care who they take down? Does it matter at all who it is that gets taken down? And I feel like they don't care. Greg Abbott lets people freeze to death. Well, that's the same thing as Andrew Cuomo giving a woman a hug that she didn't want. And that's exactly the same thing as Matt Gaetz having sex with underage girls and possibly sex trafficking. These are vastly different crimes. Some are illegal and some are not. And yet at the same time, they treat them like they're all the same, like there's as though there's no difference and that they're all equally bad and everybody should quit and everybody should go away. And of course, they're different. People complain about cancel culture as a liberal thing. It hurts liberals more than anybody. Republicans just say, fuck it, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay where I'm at. And then there's no punishment for them ever. No punishment for them ever. They never face the consequences for any of this stuff. When everything is treated as an outrage, then nothing is an outrage. When everything is equally bad in the eyes of the media, and it just really doesn't matter what it is or who did it or what the circumstances were or what the ideology behind it was, they've all got to go away. Villains benefit from a system like that. Real villains can hide in the corners of a system like that. And that kind of brings us a little bit to our topic. Because one thing I'm getting really sick of is that the idea that somebody's words are just as important as their actions, or if somebody is boorish or rough around the edges, that is as bad as somebody who always says the right thing and never does the right thing. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. I'll go a little bit in depth. In California, you find people who never say the wrong thing. Not ever. With the Campbell Hall thing that I've talked about, because it's such a clear classic example of people, the media, the journalist I was trying to talk to said, well, did they ever call him a racial slur? And I'm like, well, no, they didn't call him a racial slur, but it's in the margins, it's in the subtext, it's in what they were doing and how they were treating him. But because they never said the wrong thing, I couldn't properly punish them. Taking away a diversity and inclusion scholarship from a kindergarten kid and his family was not seen as worse than if he'd gone to school and a teacher had said a racial slur to him. One sentence would have been a big deal, and it would have been in the LA Times, and it would have gotten a teacher fired, and it would have gotten us to stay at the school if they'd said one wrong sentence. But their actions of, we will get a family to spend all this time and energy and effort to get into this school, to turn down other scholarship offers, then when they're at the school, we're going to make it as hard for them as possible to stay there. We're not going to work with them at all. We're not going to give them a different teacher. We're not going to let them come back for a second year. We're not going to offer to let them go into a different classroom. We're not going to give them more time to complete the test that we've demanded that they complete. We're not going to back off at all. We're not going to say, oh, they had a second kid. They're stressed out. They're going through, you know, a new baby, some maternity leave. We need to give them a few months to adjust to this. They didn't work with us at all, at all. There was no way you could look at their actions and say they wanted this family to stay there. They wanted to honor their scholarship. They were bending over backwards to honor their scholarship as they're putting them through ridiculous tests and a social probation contract that an adult could not pass. But because their bureaucratic language was the right way, they don't look like villains, even though they are. They changed the trajectory of a child's life, and that is devastating. They told a kindergarten kid he was bad. They made him self-conscious. They made him feel like dirt. For months, they made his family, they tried to gaslight us into thinking there was something wrong with him, that he had a problem that he doesn't have and has not had since he left that damn school. And they did this so they can put on a tax form that they offer a scholarship and all the people we gave it to, it didn't work out. It's not our problem. We did everything we could. And you see that all the time. There are bosses in Los Angeles, in New York. They're not boorish. They say the right things. They're ultra careful. They're very sensitive. Oh, you know, we care about diversity and inclusion. And they don't. They don't hire black people. They definitely don't promote them if they ever do hire them. It's like a pyramid. And the bottom layer, the fifth layer, is all black and brown and, you know, Asian and different people like that. And they say, oh, look at this wonderful Rambo coalition we bought at the bottom. Then you go up a rung and it's white women and white men. You go up a rung and it's white women and white men. You go up to the very top, it's white men and white women. Minorities within the white community are especially bad about this. White gay men think they have the exact same experience as a black person, and they don't. White women think they have the exact same experience, and they don't, okay? But this is one of those things where we don't necessarily in the liberal circles differentiate that much between the different types of minorities. We think white women and white gay men and Jewish people and Asians have the exact same experience as black and brown people. And they don't, usually. They usually have a lot better. And we don't really differentiate between that. We don't make a big distinction between the different ways minorities. In liberal circles, it's like white heterosexual men versus everybody else, you know? And that's how we see it as. And it's the patriarchy and the system and the founding fathers. And then when white women get promoted, they're just as bad. There's no real distinction. There's no differentiation. These police shootings, a disproportionate share of them are committed by white female officers. In Minnesota right now, my old state of Minnesota, I used to live in Minnesota. I'm not surprised that all this is happening there, to be honest. When you live in a place like that and you see the police and you see how they interact with people, they carry themselves like neo-Nazis. I mean, they really do. And you'll see a guy with bad attitude, got his arms folded, he's leaned up against the car, and it's a cop. And he's looking at people like, you guys are scum. You can live in Los Angeles. You can live in Minneapolis. You can see a real difference in the way the police interact with the citizens. In Minnesota, they had a Holidazzle parade, which is a big Christmas parade that kind of marches through the downtown area. And you go to the state fairs, you go to the Mall of America, you go around, you see the police, they're there. They're at the Minnesota Twins games and different things like that. They're around. They kind of look like skinheads. I mean, they've got very militaristic type attitudes. They got their arms folded. They're looking at people. They don't seem friendly. They don't seem like they're there for the right reasons. They kind of seem like those security guard types that they're doing it for all the wrong reasons, you know, and it's a little bit about respect and power and things like that. And I'm not totally surprised that this keeps happening in a place like that. You have to look at how insane it is. Minneapolis, there's the George Floyd riots and the Derek Chauvin thing. And then as this guy's on trial, as the city's already kind of a powder keg, there's another police shooting. A man gets killed by a white female officer, and her excuse is horrible. She's like, oh, I thought I reached for my taser to shoot him. That's a horrible, that's one of the worst excuses I've ever heard, because number one, it's outrageous. Like, oh, I was just going to tase him, but instead I blew his head off. I mean, that's stupid. That's ridiculous. But second of all, it kind of says your training is bad. It says that you were poorly trained in a moment's instant, in a stressful situation. Instead of a gun, you reach for a taser. Like, I don't know a law enforcement officer who would feel comfortable admitting that they were that incompetent or that scared or that frightened. This is a teenage boy. He's scared of you. You're the one that has the gun, not him. He's afraid of you. And I think the fact that the police are so afraid in situations like this, they are so scared all the time. I think this is causing a lot of problems. We are afraid of them. And especially minority communities are afraid of them. I'm afraid of them. I'm not a minority, but if I'm out driving my car around and you see a police cruiser come up behind you, if it's an SUV or a squad car, oh shit, I'm going to get a ticket. Oh shit, I'm going to get pulled over. Oh shit, do I have my current insurance forms, right? Because even if you get pulled over, even though I'm at a very, not high risk of getting murdered by the police at a traffic stop, you know, the insurance forms, I forget sometimes to print those out and put the new one in my glove box. Then you get a ticket in Los Angeles, it's over $1,000. You got to go to the courthouse, you got to sort through all this. It's a big pain in the ass, not to mention little things like seatbelt tickets or whatever, talking on phone, whatever it is. Nobody really likes to see the police, you know, because I think for most people, they associate it with a traffic ticket. If they've had any interaction with the police, it's usually something like a traffic ticket or a stop or something like that. And what are you doing? Where are you going? Asking you questions, things like that. So it's really become that the police are not a relief to most people. They kind of see them as a burden. I'm not the only one who feels this way. My father's an older, I won't say he's old, but he's definitely, you know, older. they pulled him over one night and said he was driving drunk. He wasn't driving drunk. He was tired. He was driving home from work. The job he had was a lot more physical than being a cop is. Very stressful job. Worked a hard shift. Gets off second shift, 11 o'clock. Police pull him over. Make him take a breathalyzer. Make him walk a straight line. Make him do the ABCs. They wanted so badly to write him a DUI ticket. In rural Alabama, where you think, well, they're probably sensitive to white males. They're probably sensitive to white males over a certain age. And they weren't. And I think that for a lot of people, the police, they're no longer really, it's no longer a positive thing to see them. And I think that's got to change. The culture of the police departments, they have to change. They have to stop thinking about it like this person is a DUI case. You got to stop thinking about people. They're people. Protect and serve, right? But at the same time, there's a serve component to that. It's not just about like we're protecting people from themselves. Like there's a serve component to that. It needs to be more positive to see police, for us not to be afraid of them, for them not to carry themselves like swolled up jackanapes walking around with guns and puffed up chests and steroid uses and shaved heads. We can't see them as military officers. It's not the same job. America is not that violent of a country compared to other mega countries like China, like India, like Indonesia, like Brazil, Russia, Mexico, Bangladesh, Nigeria, Pakistan. That's the rest of the most populated countries in the top 10. America is not anywhere near as violent as those countries. We like to pretend that we are. We're like, oh, we have more shooting deaths than Sweden. Okay, that's fucking Sweden, all right? You know what I'm saying? There's Sweden, there's Canada. Yeah, there's some Europe. We always compare ourselves to Europe. We're not really similar to Europe in a lot of ways. We have a population much more in line with the 10 countries I just named. We have less crime than they do. We have less violence than they do. It's not that violent a country, and police deaths are not that much for them to be consistently terrified of seeing us in different places. And the white woman to be like, oh my God, I've got a teenager pulled over. Should I pull my gun on him or my taser? Like, how about neither? Like, he's not a threat to you. And the fact that people view themselves as this is a huge part of the problem. This guy got killed in the Brooklyn Park area of Minneapolis, which is like an all-black area. And living in Minnesota is especially relevant to this episode because I can remember the white people are very clannish in a lot of ways. When I first moved to Minnesota, my wife and I, so, you know, obviously, if you listen to this before, you know, she's black. And we moved there. And the guys who helped us move our stuff in the apartment was a moving company. One dude had 88 tattooed on his hand, which is 88 is a skinhead thing. It's a neo-Nazi thing. And they both had skinheads and they gave us dirty looks the whole time. And I'm like, wow, this is some of the first people we met when we moved there. And they're helping us move our stuff into the apartment. They're like, where are you from? Or where did you move from? And at that time, we'd moved from New York. And I said, New York. And he goes, I wouldn't want to live there. There's too many. And they didn't finish what he was going to say. And this is one of the very first interactions that we had in Minnesota. And I think it really set the tone. I think there's a lot of that element there. We think of the Southeast as being a lot more racist than the Midwest. I don't think that's true at all. I don't think a lot of the Midwest is less racist than the Southeast. I don't think a lot of Los Angeles is less racist than the Southeast. But in Minnesota, we're one of the first interactions that we had. And then the black people. And if you live in Minneapolis, you'll know what I'm talking about, or if you've ever been there. But there's a lot of black people who stay out on Nicollet Mall. Or they used to. They've redone Nicollet Mall. It may be different now. But they used to just hang out on the streets all day. And there's a contingent of black men that would just literally be on the street in the Loring Park area, the Nicollet Mall area, and they just don't do anything. They just hang out. And they just hang out all day long. Any black woman that walks by, hey, Ma, what's up, sugar? What's up, sugar? And I didn't have a car in Minneapolis, so I'd have to ride the bus. And when you ride a city bus, it's really hard to be segregated. It's really hard not to know the culture of a city when you have to take public transit everywhere. In Los Angeles, it's really easy to cordon yourself off from other kinds of people because everybody drives. In Minnesota, a lot of people drive. So a lot of white Minnesotans, they don't ride the bus. They drive, and then there's the suburban areas around it. They drive to and from that or whatever. They don't really experience a lot of the city. When you're on the bus, you see a lot of black people that don't have a car. They're on the bus. The men, what's up, Ma? What's good? What you doing? What's your phone number? Let me get your phone number talking. And you look at it, and it's sort of like this is an area where people are so beaten down, and they know the opportunities just simply don't exist because there's a direct correlation between on Nicollet Mall, there's Target's headquarters, and right outside, there's, you know, 10, 20 black men hanging out all day looking for any woman that walks by them to talk to them, asking guys for money. One time, my wife walked a few steps in front of me. She was pushing our son in a stroller, and they sexually harassed the shit out of her. They're like, what's up, Ma? What's up? What's your number? What's your number? You know? And then she went and talked to him. They're like, okay then, bitch. Fine, bitch. Go on, stuck up. And that's how they talked to her. 15 steps behind or whatever, here I am. Hey, you got a dollar? You got a dollar I can borrow? And I'm like, oh my God, you know. But I mean, you see this sort of mentality to where that's right outside the building, inside Target headquarters. How many black executives do they have? Not that many. When they do get hired, do they get promoted? No. And so there's correlations between this, the lily white culture of the Minnesota business community, which is Best Buy, which is Target, which is United Health, which is a handful of other corporations like Kellogg. There's quite a few Fortune 500 companies based in Minneapolis. But if there's no black executives, there's no black CEOs, people say, oh, I carry my kids to the Minnesota school system. There's virtually no black teachers there. If you live in an area, there's no black teachers, there's no black executives, but you're surrounded by wealth because it's a fairly wealthy city. But if you can't see yourself in that, that's where a lot of the problems come from, to where you don't even feel the hope of having a better opportunity. You can't even imagine. You're right beside people all day that are wealthier than you are, and you see the way they dress, you see what they take, you see that they drive cars, you see how they interact, you see them, but they might as well be in a different planet than you are. They're breathing the same air, they're walking the same streets, but they're not exactly, because their money is so much different and the way they live is so much different. And then they get in their cars and they drive to a suburb where they have a big house and a nice lifestyle, and they don't ever see you. They don't ever talk to you. They don't want to interact with you that much. And so in a way, if you see that all the time, but you feel like it might as well be a different country, it's like a different country in that it's your area, but it's not your area. And so you have to wonder about that and think, if that's what you're seeing and you don't see yourself in that at all, ever, can it be a mystery that you don't succeed? Los Angeles is not that different, quite frankly. And in Los Angeles, you see white people and they say globalism is a great thing. It's a great thing. Unquestionably, there's no pushback to this idea that globalism is a really great thing. But then you walk right outside and you can drive down the street and there's a gigantic billboard. I wish I'd taken a picture of it, but at one point there was a gigantic billboard that said gentrification sucks. You know, a billboard is expensive. So what is that an ad for? I mean, you're literally driving down Vine or Hollywood or whatever street it was on. I can't remember. But there's a giant, and there was more than one. There was giant billboards that said gentrification sucks. And you think, well, that's not even an ad. That's not like a Coca-Cola or like a, you know, Victoria's Secret or whatever. Like, that's just an ad for an idea that gentrification sucks. But how is it that gentrification sucks? And then right beside that, the idea that globalism is a good thing. If globalism is, we take our jobs, we offshore them, our middle class suffers so that people in other countries can prosper, then they sell us cheaply made, environmentally shitty crap back to us so we can buy it at a discount, supposedly buy it at a discount. People talk about inflation in America like it doesn't exist. Well, there hasn't been bad inflation. I don't know where they're getting that from. My rent's not the same as it would have been 10 years ago. Healthcare costs have gone up. College tuition is unaffordable for most people. So I'm not sure where this idea of the right wingers always say something like, oh, well, that's only because we can't offshore those things. Right? I'm like, so the offshoring of our manufacturing jobs and our commercial goods and our products, that's hollowed out the middle class to where they can no longer afford things like college tuition and good health care. But your solution to those two things is like, oh, well, that's only because there's not offshoring in those as well. That's what they come up with. If you hollow out your wages and your jobs and your, let's say specifically jobs that don't require a college degree but still pay a decent wage, if that becomes more difficult, especially in a country where 75% of people don't have a college degree, then if you hollow that out further and further, it really becomes a bad system for the country. And I think that's why you can see the income inequality going worse and worse. The manufacturing class, they lose their jobs, and then they can no longer afford to send their kids to college, which has gone up in tuition because the tuition costs have been raised. Oh, but they can buy a cheaply made television. At a certain point, the goods themselves are not as important as the money that we're circulating back into the country. This idea that free trade is a great thing because we can buy cheaply made goods, and I'll just say cheaper made goods, because a lot of this shit's not really that as cheap as they make it sound or whatever, but they're like, oh, you don't understand, the price of a television is less because it was made in South Korea or China, usually China, and it's less than it would be if it were made in the United States. The jobs that have been lost to make that television mean that a lot of other stuff is losing the country. It's a bad way to think about it, honestly. So what they call globalism, in some ways, is a great thing. In a lot of ways, is a great thing. It's sort of strange to me that people view the economy as an island. They think about it as an island instead of an interconnected web. And so what I mean by that is you hear rich people say things like, I don't want to pay taxes not thinking about the taxes that they pay into it. They're going to fund public schools, which are going to give them better educated workers. They're going to fund roads, which are going to make their goods easier to transport. There's a thousand net benefits that they don't see, and they don't see it at all because it's all about like, no, I'm self-made. My wealth is my island. I don't want anyone encroaching my island. I don't want anybody crossing the seas, getting onto my island, stealing my wealth, taking that wealth and putting it back somewhere else. I don't want that. They don't think of it as a web, which is what it is. When you lay off 1,000 workers at a factory and offshore those jobs to China, then that's 1,000 people who no longer are in the economy to buy your products. Whatever you're making, you're going to lose them as customers. That's 1,000 fewer people that have the money to buy your goods. And then if you think about it in globalism terms, it's like, yeah, but then there's 1,000 new workers in China that are able to buy those goods instead of over here. But that's not as good. Because when they're over there, first of all, there's import-export taxes, there's fees. You know, it's not quite the exact same dollars-to-dollars ratio. But also, China has their own products. You know, some American brands do quite well there, and some of them don't. Some of them never catch fire. It's all up to the Chinese dictatorship and what they want to do, if they want to allow an American company to be successful there or not. People have put a big emphasis on the foreign box office. They're like, oh, Chinese box office, that's so huge. That's where so many big movies get their money from these days. Well, it depends. Because they take a huge percentage of that cut. Like if you hear a movie made $1 billion in China, the studios don't get $1 billion. They get whatever the Chinese government decides to give them off of that. They give whatever revenues are part of that. It's a little backwards in the way that we're thinking about it, in that globalism is a great thing. That seems to translate into offshoring jobs and then allowing workers into America that maybe they work for less. Maybe they don't have benefits. Maybe they can't go to, you know, services and complain. If you look at it as like, well, globalism and the way that a lot of people think about it, I like the idea that the cultures are blending, that it's more of a melting pot, that there's different ideas being adapted and free-flowing and some of the racial and national barriers are being broken down. But that seems to be almost the opposite of what a lot of liberals actually want with globalism. To me, it's kind of odd because I would like globalism to the extent of beautiful people from all over the world come to the United States, educated people. Maybe they marry Americans. Maybe they make them happier. If they're educated, maybe they come up with ideas. Maybe that a lot of different businesses created by immigrants or whatever. I like the idea of people are coming from all over the world. They're tearing down racial barriers. They're tearing down national barriers. There's a melting pot. There's a blending of the cultures. But liberals seem almost allergic to that idea. If Kim Kardashian wears fucking cornrows, she has to go out there and issue an apology about it. Kylie Jenner, oh, she's stealing from black culture and things like that. They've gone very, very into this idea of cultural appropriation in a way that is almost soft segregation, to be quite honest with you. You see people say things like, if a white woman wears cornrows, that's cultural appropriation. If sometimes even just interracial dating, they say is cultural appropriation. They're like, oh, people who interracially date, that's cultural appropriation. I'm like, it's getting to that point of soft segregation, where if a Hollywood movie, even a really good one, is about black people but is made by a white director. Trey Edward Schultz made a movie called Waves that was a mostly black cast. They accused him of that at that time. The movie Hidden Figures had a white director. These are the kind of things that you're almost encouraging, like, oh, black people make the black movies, and then there's no overlap of that. And that's, to be quite honest, kind of gross. And nobody ever sees it when it's the other way. Like, nobody would go up to Misty Copeland, the ballerina, and say, oh, you're culturally appropriating white culture. Ballet, that's a white thing. You need to stay the hell away from ballet. Or Audra McDonald, you shouldn't sing opera. Opera's a white thing. That's cultural appropriation. Growing up in the 90s and 00s, Eminem was a great rapper. I don't know if Eminem would be considered a great rapper if he were started today. I think people would say, oh, that's cultural appropriation. They're getting very specific into these things in a way that is actually the opposite of progress. It's actually anti-progress. It's regressing into a certain stage and kind of making things worse. I think worse in a lot of different ways, because I remember the guy from Good Times at one point said that cable television has fueled segregation in a lot of ways. Because when you had three channels, people had to kind of watch the same stuff. He said white people, they watched Flip Wilson, and black people watched Johnny Carson. Black people watched All in the Family, and white people watched Good Times, and they watched The Jeffersons. I actually really agree with that, because I can remember that not that long ago, white people would watch shows that would be considered quote-unquote black today. You know, you'd have Martin, or you'd have In Living Color, or things like that. Those were really popular shows. Even not that long ago, in my youth, I loved Key and Peele. and the Chappelle Show. And The Wire is one of the best television shows ever made. If you were to ask me today, say, name five shows you watch with a majority black cast, I couldn't do it. And I did all throughout the 90s and the 00s, but it's almost gotten to be so segmented. I'm not really sure what would be considered the black shows today or that most black people would watch. And I'm a guy who watches a lot of television and movies. I watch hundreds of movies every year. I'm just giving that as an example of, like, I'm not just sitting there watching reruns of Bonanza or whatever, you know, like, I'm actually staying plugged into the culture and what's happening. I don't know if I could tell you five shows with the majority black cast, not just that I watch, but that even exist. And it's not that they don't exist. There's entire channels that market these programs and stuff. It's just that I don't even really know what they are. And so in that way, cable television has sort of split the audience into, you know, 100 different groups, and we barely overlap with each other. We barely even know each other at a certain point. And because the cultures are not blending, they're not mixing, they're not overlapping, I don't think that millennials or Gen Y or Gen Z, I don't think that they're necessarily more likely to interracially date and marry and have kids. And that's a terrible thing. We've kept a lot of the worst components of globalism, the offshoring, the cheap labor that can't complain if they get injured, that's treated like garbage, a permanent underclass of people that we can abuse, that keep wages down. But we haven't adopted the things that would probably be good for us. An end of conflicts, of sectarian violence, of racial violence, of police shootings because someone is black. Tensions with China, which has kept all of their militarism and nationalism and protectionism and said, you can't do this, we can do that, you can't do this. You know, we've kept all the negatives of a globalist society. We've adopted almost none of the positives. Maybe we're in a transitional period. I sure hope that we are. But it sure seemed like we had it the reverse a few decades ago. Italians came to this country within a generation or two. They were no longer Italians. They were Italian Americans. They contributed to a culture and a country that they weren't just surrounded by people who were identical to them. Today, people come to this country, we don't even necessarily ask them to speak English. And even that idea, sometimes, you'd be like, well, you know, generally, if someone's going to come to the United States, it's nice if they can learn how to speak English. That's racist. Even the idea that somebody should learn English, that can sometimes be construed as racism. I'm not saying they should forget their home language, not that they really are allowed to anymore, because people are just like, oh, you got to remember your roots. You got to remember your roots. You can't ever forget your roots. I'm like, and what would be so bad if they did? What would be so bad if they really did? Like, why must we keep ourselves locked in this cultural prison where nothing can change ever? We can't allow fresh thoughts and fresh ideas to come in ever. We must maintain this. There's so much shit that we do today. I'm astounded that we still do it. I'm astounded the Catholic Church is still a thing. I'm astounded Mormons are still a thing. I'm astounded Jehovah's Witnesses are still a thing. I mean, these sects and these branches, and we must tiptoe around them, and we must act like they're sacrosanct. I knew an Indian woman years ago. This is kind of a personal story, but she liked white guys. But her dad said he would disown her if she married a white guy. And she dated a white guy, and he did. He didn't speak to her for years. Then all of a sudden, they break up, she meets an Indian guy, they get engaged, they get married, and they act like race had nothing to do with that, by the way. She's like, no, I just fell in love with this guy, and I'm like, yeah, right. But she was doing the wrong thing. She was kowtowing to pressure from other people that were not her, telling her, you got to be with an Indian guy, you can't interracially date, you can't interracially marry, you got to be with this guy who's exactly like us, we got to keep our culture alive. Never mind that you were born in America, never mind you're from Texas. You got to keep that culture alive. You can't let that culture change at all. We got to keep it exactly the same as it was. And white people don't criticize this anymore. We don't look at this and say, this is gross. It is gross to keep these things prisoner and hostage. My son in Los Angeles can go to a park with Korean kids. They won't play with him. They won't talk to him. They'll leave. They'll run away. They will run from him. And we don't criticize that and say, that's gross. It's gross that anybody still acts this way anymore. But we look at that, and if it were white people that would do that, we would say, that's terrible. And it is terrible. It's terrible if anybody does that. But when Korean kids do it, it's like, well, that's just their culture. You know, they feel more comfortable around people who are identical to them. That is gross. And we should be able to say that and have a conversation about that and criticize that. Feel free to criticize that. But we don't. We don't even really discuss how these things are hurting the United States anymore. The woman I was talking about a second ago, she got divorced, of course. Years later, after she'd cranked out a couple of kids, after she'd gotten in a marriage and kids that she never should have been in the first place. But me, I'm the asshole because I say, well, you shouldn't just marry someone because they're your ethnicity and they're your same identity and they look like they could be your damn brother, for God's sakes. They look very similar, very similar. I'm the asshole for saying that, but I'm not really the asshole. Then they get divorced years later and it's like, oh, you don't understand. It's more complicated than you think. I'm like, it wasn't that complicated. You gave in to pressure from people who weren't you to maintain an ideal that you never should have been asked to carry on in the first place. In some ways, when you meet people who are second generation, they're more into their culture than people who move here from other places. You meet somebody's like, yeah, I moved here from the Philippines a year ago, and they might be less interested in keeping that alive than somebody who's like, my grandmother was from the Philippines, but I'm Filipino-American. I'm very much from the Philippines, the country they've never lived in and never been to. But they keep that very tenuous connection going. You do see that sometimes. I mean, you see Nigerians who literally moved here from Nigeria, were born and raised there, they're adults. And then you meet the grandkid, like somebody's grandfather was Nigerian. They're like, I'm Nigerian-American. You ever been there? No. Even if they had, so what? You go there for 2 fucking weeks? You're from Brooklyn. You're born and raised from Brooklyn. You know what I mean? But it's just that's just how we process that, to where it's almost better to be anything else but American. And you say that, and that sounds somewhat nationalistic, even though you may not be, even though it's not like you're saying America. I think there's a kind of a backwards idea. In global society, people say Americans are so arrogant. They think they're better than everybody else. They think they're just the best in the world, that nobody can be as good as them, whatever. And I actually don't see it that way. I kind of see it as the opposite. I almost feel like Americans put themselves down more than any other country in the world. You get around Canadians. Canadians have this sort of like, almost like a kid brother complex or something. America thinks they're so great, but we're the ones who are really great. You know what I mean? It's almost like this sort of passive aggressive superiority. There are Canadian supremacists out there, my friends. There absolutely are. But it's a little bit like, America thinks they're so great. We have gun control and healthcare. We're actually better than they are. But it's so funny that everybody thinks that they're so great, you know? So you see a lot of countries, Europe does it a lot, Canada does a lot. They kind of put America down and talk about the arrogance of the United States or whatever, even as they themselves are saying that they're better than us in all these different ways, which is kind of just as arrogant if you think about it, but they don't see it that way. But I think that generally this idea that gentrification is such a harmful and negative process, I think that kind of boils down to money to an extent, but it's not just money really. There was a great play called Clybourne Park that came out on Broadway a few years ago, and it's two different stories. The first story is set in like the 60s or something, but it's a majority white neighborhood and a black family is moving in and they're trying to convince them not to move in. They're afraid that black people moving in will lower the property values. That's how they claim it as. They're really just afraid of black people moving in. They don't want them in their neighborhood. But then there's a second story, which is where it's more contemporary and it's years later, decades later, more like the times we live in now, where the black people don't want the white people to move in because they're afraid of gentrification. So I'm like, 50 years ago, we would be against that mentality because we're like, you're pro-segregation. You don't want black people to move in because then they're going to lower the property value. So you say, or that's the reason you don't like it. And that's what you're deadly against. Today, the black people don't want the white people to move in. They're like, oh, they're going to raise the property values. We can't afford to live here anymore. We're going to have to move out. We're going to be forced to go somewhere else. You know, all that property value shit, I don't know. I think some of it boils down to the culture of a neighborhood. They're trying to maintain it. It's a little bit about supremacy. We want people like us around us all the time. And that's what it really boils down to. People have gotten to this point where they cannot be comfortable around people who are not identical to them. And that's a very negative thing. I think it's a negative thing for society. I think it's negative for that individual. People used to embrace other stuff, and to an extent, liberals still do. But I don't think it's gotten better. Back in the 1960s, they'd say, I'm going to go to Brazil. I'm going to do carnival. I'm going to travel. I'm going to do this. I'm going to embrace these different things. They've been doing that forever. Today, they might be just about less likely to do it, because they're like, oh, I don't want to culturally appropriate, but that's bullshit. A lot of it comes down to they want to stay on Twitter. They want to be glued to Twitter or Facebook or social media. They're not really like going out there in the world anymore. Mark Lilla in the book Once and Future Liberal, he had a great thesis about this where he talked about identity politics is sort of inverting liberalism to the extent of it used to be liberals wanted to go out in the world. They wanted to mix in the world. They wanted to explore the world and in some ways change the world. Now it's almost becoming to where that's frowned upon. If you were to say, I want to go to China, I want to open them up, I want them to be democratic, you shouldn't be forcing your beliefs down their throat. Maybe they're happy being fascist slaves under a dictatorship. You know, maybe they're happy being like that. I want to go to the Middle East. I want women to throw their burqas away. I want women's liberation. No, you're Islamophobic. You shouldn't be doing that, you know? And it's almost becoming to where they've inverted liberalism to the extent of, if you're a white woman, you think you've got it worse than anybody else on the planet who's ever lived. And so you're exclusively concerned with ideas that affect white women. And you don't want to extend that feminism to the world. You know, white women in America, they should be a little bit more upfront about the dangers. Women internationally, Pakistan and India and a lot of countries are extremely dangerous places to be women, but they've inverted it into being like, well, you know, other countries are other countries and that's their culture. And who are we to judge their culture? Who are we to judge arranged marriage, which is an insane fucking topic? And they're like, who are we to judge that when we have our own culture and we do things our way? They've inverted it to the point of, if it's not me and my group and my identity and people who are exactly like me, why should I give a shit? That's not how they phrase it. They don't phrase it that way, but that's essentially what they're saying, to where they should be more concerned with their group than anybody else. Obviously, I think that's a very dangerous thing and a very negative thing. So I'm curious to know what people kind of think about this. Is globalism good or bad? And if the answer is the same for globalism, shouldn't it be the same for gentrification? If globalism is bad, shouldn't gentrification be bad? But if globalism is good, shouldn't gentrification be good? Are they basically the same thing? One idea that I'll never be able to really get over that I've always loved, there was a season of South Park where their whole thesis was basically that gentrification, that political correctness was a gentrification of the mind and of the mouth and of the tongue, that you're covering up ideas that are ugly or negative or that you don't want to see around anymore. And it wasn't necessarily that it was making society better, that it was making the reality better, but it was just sort of changing the way people talked about it. It's manipulating reality to a certain extent. And I think that's really what the main thing that possibly the whole podcast is really trying to get at, possibly all the 100 episodes that will eventually come out. The big theme is the manipulation of reality to the point of what you're seeing. And I know this sounds like, you know, Trump is like, what you're seeing is not what's happening. What you're hearing people say is not what's actually being, you know, he's framing it that way. But, you know, of course, him saying that is its own reality. And this idea that you can manipulate the fabric of reality to conform it to whatever you like it to be is, Trump's no longer a bad president. He's misunderstood and the media won't give him a break. If you can't wrap your mind around basic truths or some type of consistency, then it really all becomes kind of meaningless, because then it's just going to change on the wind or whatever. So I think that if gentrification is basically seen as a negative thing for the people who live in that area, maybe it's not a negative thing. I know that it would be in a money sense, if you say, well, it's raising the rent so that we can't live here anymore. But at the same time, the same people who live in those areas, what do they say? There's no good stuff here. There's no mall here. There's no movie theater here. There's no, you know, shops. The same thing that they were complaining about 20 years ago. The gays are moving in. They're going to have a floral shop here. They're going to have their own businesses. They're going to raise the rent prices. We won't be able to afford it. We're going to be pushed out. But then when that's not happening to a neighborhood, they've given up on this neighborhood. This neighborhood's a dump and nobody wants to help us and nobody cares about us. So it becomes a little inconsistent. If you live in a shitty, economically depressed region, don't you want it to change so that it can get better? And if it never changes and stays the same, and then you're just like, well, this place is hopeless and they don't care about us, how is that better? And how does that help you? What's the solution? If the solution is not, we need to reform the neighborhood, we need to bring in some new blood, we need to cycle this out, we need to mix the people up. It's not good to have an area of Minneapolis like Brooklyn Park that is almost 100% black, and then other areas like Edina and some of the nicer areas that are almost 100% white. That kind of segregation is not helping anyone. We've got to kill this idea that you can have these neighborhoods. And so I look at gentrification as a positive thing. But then they say, well, yeah, but we can't afford to stay here anymore. And they've pushed us from Manhattan. We used to be in Harlem. Now we're not in Harlem. But still fucking black people in Harlem. I don't know where people got this idea from. But they say, well, you know, we pushed us from Manhattan to Brooklyn. Now they're trying to gentrify Brooklyn. They're going to push us into the ocean next or whatever. And I'm like, no, it is somewhat about money. But this idea that you can keep an area completely segregated and isolated and just 100% one thing, and that's somehow going to lead to massive prosperity, I think that idea's got to die. I think it's analog. I think it's dated. I think it's been proven not true over and over again. The idea that black people now sometimes view integration as a bad thing for them, that's got to die. I don't know who told people that could ever be possible. They're like, oh, no, there's 100% black areas in Atlanta that are very prosperous, and we can have that all over the country. I don't know who told you that. First of all, Birmingham, Alabama is a blacker city than Atlanta is. Atlanta's like 55% black or something. They think of that as a very chocolate city. Birmingham's like 90% black. There are a lot more black cities than Atlanta in terms of like percentages and things like that. But I still think that this idea that you can completely isolate yourself, and that's the key to prosperity. That's somehow going to like build you. And rednecks think the same thing. Rural people think the same thing. White people think, if only we can just kick out all these immigrants and have a 100% white society, if only we can take over the state of Montana and we'll set up an all-white colony of Montana, and that'll be, yeah, you know, Montana, GDP. Does it compete with California? No. New York? No. The GDP of Montana is not what's fueling the United States. If it was just left to Montana as its own place, if they seceded, and if white people really did that, if all the white racists moved to one state and they seceded from the country, it would be insolvent within 2 years with that blue state tax revenue propping it up. We got to kill these ideas that you can separate yourself and that's the key to prosperity. It's not. And if we can kill that, I think we'll be better. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. Hope that this was at least interesting for you. If you want to share your thoughts about globalism and gentrification on the comments of Alabama Liberal, or whatever, however you want to do it. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. AlabamaLiberal.com is a great place where you can comment on anything I write. Usually, if you ask a question, I'll respond to you or something. The YouTube channel is a good place. Okay, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for episode 84.